It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
We talk about food, we talk about journeys, we talk about everything literally all over the world. Well, now we're going to talk about a center for food and that takes on the whole world. We're going to talk about the World Food Center. It's at UC Davis, and I'm happy to welcome Kent Bradford, who is the interim faculty director of the World Food Center. Kent, welcome to Farm to Table Talk.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So, Kent, you have been at UC Davis for how many years?
I became a faculty member in 1982, so that makes 36 years, I guess, right now.
Well, that's a long time. Did you ever think you'd be heading the World Food Center?
That really was not certainly not part of my original vision, and it only entered into my thoughts the last couple of years, actually, when it became when they asked me to do it.
So your background, did you grow up on a farm?
Or? Yeah, I'm from a farm in the Texas Panhandle, so halfway between Lubbock and Amarillo. So it was irrigated plains type of agriculture, corn, wheat, cotton, those types of things.
A lot of cotton down there.
Yeah. Still in the cotton business. My family's also in the ginning cotton.
So how did they let you out of there and come and end up in Davis? Because I thought everybody in that part of the world had to go to Texas A&M.
Well, it's either Texas A&M or UT or Texas Tech, so there is quite a division. But I left, went to Michigan State instead. So I took off at 18, I did my bachelor's at Michigan State in biochemistry and then a master's there in horticulture, and then came to UC Davis and did my PhD in plant physiology. So I never went back. So, yeah, I was there, my brother stayed and did the farm, but I took off.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's an interesting journey. So you find yourself chasing all these things. And when you were back there in the panhandle of Texas, what made you think that you needed to get an advanced education in agriculture?
Well, it's interesting. When I was growing up, I was kind of a sciencey guy, and a lot of very exciting things happened during that period when I was in high school in terms of discoveries about how genetics worked, how DNA worked, and so on. I actually, in doing a report in my English class, of all things, I discovered that Watson and Crick's paper about the structure of DNA, classic paper, was published the week I was born. So
oh, darn.
Somehow I found significance in that. So that's 65 years ago that we first started really getting a picture of that. So that I decided I was going to go be a molecular biologist, and that was too much biochemistry. So I went back and said, well, at least I can I can apply some of these things in plants, which is kind of where my roots were.
So you got to Michigan, and then you ended up, now did you say you finished and got your PhD at UC Davis?
Yeah, I did. Mm-hmm.
And you probably noticed along the way that the winters are better out here.
Well, I did have 6 winters in Michigan, and that was enough.
Yeah, well, I've had a lot of Midwest. There's a lot to love about the Midwest, but January is not one of them in my book. But
well, I always said I really liked spring, summer, and fall, but the other 9 months of the year, I really didn't care much.
So you've come back to Davis, and we're going to make our way to the World Food Center. But I want a little bit more on just finishing out some of the things that you've worked on. So when you were at Davis, were you conducting research and teaching classes?
Yeah, I've been a professor since I arrived, and taught classes in a lot of different topics about plant physiology. I've taught classes on ethics and genetics, ethics and biotechnology. I've taught philosophy of science. I've taught all kinds of things. But the core of it has always been some plant-related, plant physiology, or seed biology. My main specialty is in seed biology, so most of my research and big fraction of my teaching is related to seeds.
Well, when you talk about seeds, that's been an area that's been somewhat controversial because genetic engineering has evolved around. It's not only used for seeds, but it's been controversial on the seed front and a lot of conversation. So did you see that coming when you were starting to do work and starting to get more involved in genetic engineering and all the things that are happening now? When did you see this coming down the road, that you're back as a researcher and maybe not only recognizing how fast these changes would come about, but possibly even anticipating that there could be some controversy associated with them?
Well, I think for those of us who are doing research in this area, it was sort of a continuous process. If you saw interesting traits in plants that you might want, whether it's disease resistance or quality traits or whatever, and then you progressed to where you could understand that those traits were encoded in the DNA, and that if you could have that piece of DNA, you could have the trait, mm-hmm. and that you could easily improve crops by focusing on those particular traits, those particular pieces of DNA. I mean, we were able to do it otherwise, but it just a big, long process to mix all the genes together, make a cross with wild germplasm, for example, or wild plants, and then sort it back out. But, of course, that's what breeding does, and we're still able to do that. I think at the time, I don't think we really did anticipate the big controversy. I started a center here called the Seed Biotechnology Center in 1999, which looked about like when the full applications were about to take off, but at the same time, that was the same year, essentially, that the EU put a moratorium on all those crops and went a very different direction. So since then, it's been, we've had a struggle, really, to fully utilize all the technologies that we have, and there have been some successes. So there's been, billions of crop acres grown, but in terms of numbers of crops affected, the number of traits out there is really still quite small.
Well, when you talk about crops that you could apply this genetic engineering to, there in California there are like 320 different crops. Have something been tried on most everything? Has there been genetic research that might be considered genetic engineering on almost all or just a small portion of the crops?
Lots of them. We did a review, and it's been a while now, 2010, I think we did that prior to that. We found that there was research on, at that point, I think 78 species of crop plants and over 200 and something different traits that had been looked at least at the lab level, but we're down to five major crops that really have had commercial results get out, a few more coming out now, but we have not been able to utilize those types of technologies in most of the small crops which are grown. I mean, the specialty crops grown in California, the tree crops, vegetables, and so on. The regulatory costs and associated legal issues about international transportation and use around the world and so on are just way too costly for most of the smaller crops to really take advantage of. I mean, we're going to be facing some of those issues. For example, we have a disease coming into citrus now that we are going to be challenged to deal with without using some of these techniques. So it may be up to people to decide, am I going to allow some of these techniques, or am I not going to have fresh oranges?
I wondered about that. So what are the five crops that use genetic engineering, you said, that are prominent?
Well, corn, cotton, soybeans, canola, sugar beets. We have, a good example from the early days is papaya, disease-resistant, virus-resistant papaya in Hawaii that basically saved the Hawaiian papaya industry. And if you buy Hawaiian papayas, those are the ones, because they're the ones that they can survive and are not killed by the disease. We have some new ones. There's an apple out now that when you cut it, it doesn't turn brown, and there's some mushrooms that do that and so on. So, there have been a few other things, but the main ones have been the two traits, just insect resistance and herbicide resistance in those big major agronomic crops.
And those have been controversial. I'm not looking to have another podcast on that right now.
Because
you can go on and on, and there's a lot of issues involved there, but
just mention, though, that if, I think people tend not to recognize that one of those major traits is insect resistance that's greatly reduced pesticide use, and you know, a lot of our specialty crops, diseases are a big issue, and we could utilize these technologies to stop fungicide use and so on. So I think most of the uses we envision would be environmentally beneficial.
I just went to our farmer's market last week, and they had wire mesh over almost everything because of Mediterranean fruit fly. And it really kind of changed the vibe of a farmer's market because of that. Is there anything in the hopper that can help with insect resistance for something like the Mediterranean fruit fly?
Well, there are. I think, we're entering a new level of opportunities, really, where we could actually make our crop plants very specifically resistant to very specific insects or diseases. So I think this is where we want to go. Instead of the prior period, we sort of had the plants make an insecticide, even though that's a very safe insecticide and used in organic to spray on and so on. It's still, it's adding something to the plant. But there's other ways now to specifically turn off certain biochemical activities in an insect so that it doesn't survive, but it also doesn't do that to anything but that particular insect that starts biting on the plant. So, this is, I think, where we need to have a re-examination. That is, we have much more precise, much more targeted technologies that could replace a lot of the sort of very broad sledgehammer type approaches we've had. And, just go after the very specific insect that's causing problems.
You were mentioning that the citrus issue, and it's interesting because some of the same people that have been critical of genetic engineering are saying this may be one that they have to really get behind. I was even at a meeting, I know, where Michael Pollan was making that comment, that this might be one of the best places to see that we really have to look at genetic engineering to deal with this issue. So I think it's interesting because people are starting to, and not leaders like that, are starting to say, well, maybe there's some circumstances that this is the only way that might fix the issue.
Well, I think so. Florida has basically lost their citrus industry due to the same combination of an insect transmitting a virus or a bacterium to the plants. But, there have been a lot of work on ways that we could make those plants resistant and really haven't been able to use them because they do require a little bit of this technology. In California, we have an even more interesting example where we might be able to actually use a virus to transfer that little bit of technology to the trees, and so it's basically like giving them a shot. In other words, plants don't have a nice blood system where you can just put a shot in like we get with a vaccine and it goes systemic and creates immunity. But in this case, it's almost like that, except we would just use a little virus to go to the trees, and then it would spread the resistance through those trees. The problem about citrus, if we start over again with trees that are resistant, that means we have to regraft all those trees and grow them all back up to mature trees, whereas with this other approach, we may be able to actually vaccinate them as standing trees, which would save everybody a lot of trouble.
Well, let's shift gears to the broader picture now. You've been very much involved in this, but now let's look at the World Food Center. There's a lot of superlatives here to consider because, it's been pointed out that the UC Davis is generally acknowledged or almost a consensus as the number one university in the world. Some people say that perhaps second to one, what is it, the Netherlands? Or
Wageningen, yeah.
Yeah, but that's even arguable. And I'm sure that some of the other wonderful ag schools we have argue as to exactly how that rating goes. But for the most part, you won't get too much argument that they view UC Davis as the world leader in food and agriculture. So it's not such a bold step, maybe, to claim the World Food Center, but that's a pretty strong phrase to have on your business card. Do you have any trouble living that one down?
Well, we had a World Food Center that started a few years ago, started in about 2013, actually, and that was the name picked by the chancellor, and I think it reflected the vision. That was when, one of the times when one of these polls came out and did say UC Davis was number one in the world, and so I think maybe that that helped. But I don't think there's any doubt. If you travel around the world, you mention University of California, Davis, in the agriculture world, it's a carte blanche entree to acceptance. Davis, UC Davis, is not the most famous of the UCs. Certainly, Berkeley, UCLA, you know, people around the world know more about them. But in the agriculture world, Davis is definitely the place. We're certainly on the top one or two or three around the world. So it's it's a bit of a hubris to claim the whole world. But on the other hand, when you think about it, we do have currently have programs that are operating all over the world. We have one of the most spectacular agricultural production regions in the world in California, and so I think our job is to live up to that.
put that
standard out there, and let's see if we can do it.
So, how many people are associated with the university that are carrying out programs now, literally around the world, outside of California, that might be in foreign countries or other states?
Oh, I couldn't put a number on it, but we have actually an associate vice chancellor right now for global affairs, and we have a target for that all of our students here should have some international experience of some type. So we have a big push on that. In terms of actual projects related to food, there are dozens and hundreds
all over the world. So I could go to somewhere in Asia or Africa and bump into someone that's associated with the University of California.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, there's not too many places really that we don't have some. If we were to put pins in a map, a global map, we would have, it's not always formal programs and grants and so on, but collaborators, that is, our faculty in the different areas have colleagues and have active programs with other researchers and academics all over the world.
So when you cover your world, the other thing that strikes me is even closer to home here in California, everybody thinks of full-time farmers as the primary group that the Extension Service and the land-grant university works with. But you reach into cities and rooftops and urban farming, and it seems like that's another place you broaden. We usually think of broaden, as, again, like going from state level to nationwide to worldwide, but also the depth of going from big farms to small farms to urban farms to rooftops. Those feel like they're all frontiers to you too, Ken.
You're absolutely right. We have to give also a lot of credit to our colleagues who are in the Cooperative Extension Service. So, UC Davis is part of the Agricultural Experiment Station, which has teaching, research, service, and extension all as its goals. And the Extension Service is very important locally, also internationally, but. When I became interim director of the World Food Center, the term "world" to me certainly did not exclude local. I think we're part of the world, and so I don't really see any limit to our mandate. And I've been very clear about saying that to me, we have those mutual constituents and stakeholders, starting local here in the Sacramento region. Throughout California, because of our agriculture, throughout the nation, and then globally as well. And if you're going to think about food, you have to be thinking that way. Our food supply systems encompass all of those scales as well. And so, the more we start thinking about food systems, you have to start thinking globally.
You know, Ken, I've done a little bit of research into all the things you've got going on, and you've had so many centers and institutes and so forth, and it kind of feels to me like you're putting a tent over all of it. It's off like some of these were already up and going, that there was, and now there's many, I don't know, several dozen or scores or something, of centers and institutes working in various areas of everything you can think of, I think, related to food and agriculture. But it seems like you're coming in and trying to pull it all together with the center.
Yeah, that's really what struck me when I came on board, is that we do have a lot of centers. When I came in, I said, well, what's the landscape? What do I have to work with here? In the college, just in the College of Agriculture, I started looking at, we found 35 to 40 individual research or extension centers and institutes. As I mentioned, I run one of those, and I know the dozen or so in my close to my area, but I had no idea we had 40 of them. So part of my goal has been meet with those directors of all those centers, and they span all the way from the microbes and the biochemistry all the way out to food systems and food technology and health, nutrition. And that's the nature of food. I mean, we all eat every day, so it affects every part of our life. So the great thing about it is it really means we have a sort of a cross matrix of expertise here. That is, we have the formal system, which is the deans and the departments and the teaching and the curriculum and training students and so on, which has a very formal structure. Then we have this little bit more informal structure in the sense that those centers, institutes, and so on can go across that that structure and draw from different departments and be very interdisciplinary and also target very specific problems. So I think it's a huge asset. And you're right, we don't need another one of those called the World Food Center to just come and crowd into that space. What we need is people thinking seriously about how do we capitalize on that enormous resource. We are number one. We have all of these individual centers and so on. How do we marshal that to tackle the really big problems we have, whether it's locally or globally? And a lot of those are the same. We're facing climate change, we're facing water issues, pest issues. These are universal.
Well, you're raising the question that I would have asked you anyway. How do you do that? How do you get your arms around all of this? And maybe what's an example of something where you're pulling and creating synergies or facilitating the teams coming together to solve a problem or fill a need related to food and agriculture?
Yeah, well, we're taking several steps on that already. Last spring, May and June, twice we had what we called Food for Thought showcases. So we just had opportunities where we had about 20 of these centers, and each of those get up, give a 2-minute elevator speech, and then have a booth outside where all those people could come and mix. We had over 500 people show up just to find out what we have going on here. So about a third of which were external to the campus and therefore learning about what we have to offer.
I was there. And I was amazed because you got everybody get up there for 2 minutes, and I don't think you got everybody had time even at that.
Well, no, everybody, it was tough on people to only do that, but it's just a taste. But then there's a chance to go out, and I've heard many people say, you know, that they found interesting opportunities or they didn't know that was there. So that was just the start. This coming year, right now, we have a call out to those same groups or anybody on campus, departments, centers, whatever. We will provide a little bit of funding to help them pull together a workshop, a conference, some type of event. The only real requirement is that they collaborate with another center or group. That is, we're trying to get them to start talking to each other and do something on a little bit higher stage, make that happen.
So how do you promote that collaboration? You think it's a good idea to pull together? I mean, do you recognize some dynamics they're going over in one center and say, oh my gosh, you know, these guys are doing something really, really similar, and I think that if we can get you both together, I mean, do you, like, try to schedule the meeting, set up the meeting room, or facilitate? How do you do that?
Well, we do that also. We've identified different issues that are going on that we've done that. So, for example, a big issue now is the utilization of high technology, meaning data sensing, data analysis, apps on your phone, all these types of things, remote sensing from space. Lots of things happening and a lot of groups wanting to get into the agriculture space with that. Here we are. We got Silicon Valley down the road. We've got the number one ag institution in the country right here. And we have the most diverse agriculture and the most interesting climate. So basically, we have all the opportunities to make those types of advances occur. So that's, we've done some of that. That is just getting those groups together from, say, animal people, plant people, all of them together. We have a smart farm project here on campus that's, doing a lot of that as well. So part of it is trying to identify some opportunities and bring people together. The other thing is to just set some ideas out there and see who shows up, in a sense. These workshops we're sponsoring are around the theme of of aligning the food system. Well, aligning the food system for what? For food safety, for nutrition, for environmental sustainability. So we're not specifying that. So you think of that. You think of what we could align the food system for in your area, and then collaborate with some others. Because when we say align the food system, you're going across scales. You're going across from production, you're going to distribution, you're going to processing, marketing, consumers, and so on. So I think just by picking the right topics, you can get people to start collaborating.
Well, certainly you could also take the lead in sustainability, and that includes maybe especially water, water quality, water safety, water availability, drought resistance, those things. And I think there must be hundreds of people that have got their fingers on those kind of issues just at Davis alone, I would guess.
Well, yeah, we have a whole department in land, air, and water resources very focused on water issues. We have others on hydrology and, you know, the natural water system. You know, it's a big challenge. California, of course, is only the best agricultural space in the world if we have water. So we have to figure out how to share that water among all the crops and foods that we need to grow, and also the people, the cities, fish, everything. You know, it's a challenge. It's going to be a challenge, and I think agriculture on its part is doing the best it can to maintain productivity and reduce water use as much as possible. So a lot of
We got water, we got sunshine, and one of the other components, and you got the technology you're mentioning, but we got soil. And the thing is that soils are very, very different, and people seem to be just getting more, paying more and more attention to the microbe level in the soil and what influence that has not only on the crop growth, but all the way through into nutrition. That seems like that's an area that's kind of wide open to connect the dots yet. People are looking at nutrition and the role of the microbes in the human body, but also whether there's any correlation at all to the health of the soils.
Wow, this is a huge area right now. I think, you know, as you say, we've discovered that that our digestion really works by bacteria in our bodies, not by us. And plant people are finding the same, that access to nutrients and prevention of disease, various things can be greatly influenced by the microbes we have in the soil. So I think that, you know, again, I'm a both-and type of person. I think, you know, modern technology doesn't mean we don't feed the soil, that we don't take care of organic matter, that we don't, you know, put that first. So we're very fortunate in California that you know, a lot of our ag lands are very, very good, very deep, rich soils. We're not pressured as much by erosion and some of the things that are in the Midwest. But I don't think at all that our ideas now are to sort of that the soil is just some sort of substrate that we're going to add all the nutrients we're going to grow plants in. It's clearly a biological system. The microbes are critical, and also increasingly looking to soils to be a place where we could, in fact, pull carbon out of the air. That is, store organic matter in soils and build up organic matter and help pull carbon back out.
By primarily cover crops and what minimum tillage and that sort of thing, and planting things that are sucking in that carbon and producing oxygen. And
yeah, I mean, it will have to involve cover crops and so on, and that's challenging for us. You know, some of our highly productive areas, we grow crops three or four times a year, and there's not a lot of window there, perhaps, for cover crops. But we have colleagues, Jeff Mitchell down in Fresno, the colleague who's been working on this for a long time. Minimum tillage, that is, every time you plow, you put carbon in the air. So if we can find ways to leave the soil undisturbed, you know, do the minimal disturbance that we can, we find that that's what we should do. You know, the symbol of agriculture is a plow. We have to get away from that. Mm-hmm. We really should not be, you know, if we go more to drip irrigation, where we don't need to make furrows and so on, we leave those furrows where they are and we don't put the tractors over the whole space, reduce compaction, so there's a lot of things that we know. The trick is to incorporate those things into our highly productive systems in an economical way, you know, put them to use. So there's a lot of, I think that's where the real research is how do we make those things work economically with, you know, the land prices, the water, the issues that we have, to make that part of the system pay off.
Well, and you know, I have visited some urban farming, some gardens, some people that are creating edible gardens in their yards, converting yards. Incredible how much they're producing. They're following their practices. And then I know some farmers that have got thousands and thousands of acres, and they're following their practices. And one thing that I find just incredible, and it's something that we should do a shout out to the UC system and the extension system, is that in each case, they find somebody to help them. Whether it's the Master Gardener program and some of those things available in the cities, or some of the extension specialists and the commodities that are out there working with the large scale, too. That's a lot to cover. So moving ahead then, Kent, how do you make sure that you keep improving the ways that you reach all these audiences, that of the very small and local to the larger scale, more industrial type of production systems? How are you going to serve them all?
Well, that's a big challenge. It starts all the way from the research. I mean, sometimes the problems are different for those different scales, so we need to have research that's directed toward the actual problems or the actual solutions, finding the solutions for those specific things. And then, as you say, we need to have the close collaboration with industry to be, one, to know what the problems are, two, to deliver concepts or ideas that might be solutions and then put them into practice. So the extension service is critical for that, and they do try to have farm advisors and specialists in all those scales. That is, sir, we have small farm system, small farm program. We have dedicated people for different types of crops. We have multi-specialists that are working in areas where there's a lot of different crops and so on. It's quite challenging. It's particularly given that the funding for that side of things is certainly not increasing. I think that as the When the experiment station system was created in the 1860s, over half the people in the U.S. were on the farm, rural. Now it's down to a much smaller fraction, and even smaller fraction that's actively involved in producing food. And so I think the financial support for that system has eroded. And yet, when you think about it, even more people are here today, and they all want to eat. And so the fact that we've become efficient and fewer people can do that doesn't mean that that ag has lost any of its value.
So you get outside money, too. So of these centers and institutes, generally, what are the sources of money? I mean, there can be a certain amount, I imagine, from state or from the federal level, but there must be grants and projects coming from nonprofits and companies that are funding research, aren't they?
Yeah, we have the whole spectrum. If you start a little more, say, on the ecology side or the landscape side, a lot of that is state money or Forest Service or government money. I think most faculty, as you move along toward more and more specific things, we have many of our major commodities, walnuts, almonds, they're some of our biggest commodities now, lettuce and so on. Those groups have organized themselves to tax themselves, essentially, for research funds. So those commodities, if you think on the other end, fund a lot of research themselves. In between, of course, all the faculty are looking for grants at the state and the federal level, NGO level. Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is funding global agriculture on a scale as big as the whole U.S. government virtually right now. So, there's all the way across, and then, of course, collaborating directly with industry as well.
Well, and that makes people nervous. Everybody liked the good old days when there was enough money coming from USDA that it did the majority, because what people are mistrustful anymore of big corporations, and so when they hear that research at these universities is funded from large corporations, some people are suspicious, but nobody seems to have a better alternative.
Well, I certainly appreciate that that sense is out there. But on the other hand, I guess I turn the thing around a little bit, in the sense that eventually that's where most of the food is going to come for people. I mean, local production is great, but the fraction of the actual food people eat that is supplied by that is relatively small. So a lot of food is produced by large growers, and it's prepared by large food companies. So to just try to exclude them, it excludes their impact. In other words, if academics who have a broader perspective are not interacting with those groups, we're not bringing other ideas to them. That is, we're not bringing a sensitivity to the environmental impacts or things like that. So I think the idea that we should not interact with those industries, particularly in an agricultural experiment station, it is part of our mission. I mean, I don't think that we can do our mission in the ag experiment station without interacting with the agricultural industry at all scales, from the low scale to the big scale.
Yeah, my personal opinion, too, is it's just in everything there just has to be a lot of transparency. That's why I think that one reason I have a podcast, but I think it's also companies, individuals, universities are trying to tell a story, explain what they're doing, have no secrets.
You can look at it in a couple of different ways. I have the area that I have experience in, as we mentioned, on crop improvement and so on. I can say that the most misinformation out there is being put out by the NGOs, not by the companies.
Mm-hmm.
I think the real fundamental thing that's really scary to many of us right now is if we move away from making our decisions and our opinions based on facts, this is a problem. And I believe that it's something happening in our society, and it's very disturbing to scientists, where we're here working, we're trying to figure out how things work, and I can just say this, I can't imagine any company you might work with that would want us to provide them with false data. That is, what good does that do them? All we're trying to figure out, if you're working with a company, all they want and all we want to do is just find out what's happening. What are the facts of the situation? Does this work or does it not? So this whole concern that somehow if it's industry funded, it's false, that just doesn't, it's just not based on reality.
So I don't know how much you can reach outside of agriculture, but for the World Food Center, it sounds to me like you need to get social psychologists in here too.
Well, we have those actually, and we have a human ecology department here that has a lot of social scientists, and a lot of, for example, one of my colleagues here who's he's a almond production guy. He's working with the almond industry and working directly with agriculture. But one of his primary questions right now is what are the social factors that can prevent uptake of new technologies that might be beneficial or new strategies? Or we could think the other way around. One of the biggest issues right now in nutrition is people's diets. So it's a huge social factor that people control their own diets, what they eat, and the system reacts to that. So it's really a social issue of how do we, at the same time in California, we have one of the highest malnutrition rates for kids, and we also have one of the highest obesity rates. So on the both ends of the spectrum, diets are really critical, and that's really a social issue.
And like so many things, people can Google and find the answers they're looking for on every single issue. If they're predisposed to believe one way or the other, it's harder for those people that used to think they were doing their own research and go online and be able to add it all up and say, aha, this is the solution.
That's very difficult. And, unfortunately, we found in the last couple of years that there are groups out there that are actively stirring up dissent on all issues now.
Yeah, yeah.
Which makes it very frustrating. As you say, I mean, the Internet is such an incredible resource to go and find information, but it's also very tricky to know which information is really accurate. I think that's a role that the university could play. I wish more people would come to UC Davis websites and to these centers and institutes first, rather than just going to whatever pops up first on Google.
Well, so let's go to that. So if people want to know more about the center and the institutes that make up the center and find a way to start digging in and finding whoever it is could answer their problems or talk to them about their issues, where do they start? Where do they look to find that information?
Well, our website is just worldfoodcenter.ucdavis.edu. It's still, we're revamping it, and we have a new version coming out quite soon. So right now, you won't find all the centers and institutes, but very soon, that'll be one place to start. You can look up the College of Agricultural and Environmental Sciences at UC Davis. They have a lot of good information, and they have, you know, highlights of different activities that are going on. You know, a good thing to do is just come to UC Davis site and then put in the search words what you're looking for, and there'll be plenty there.
My final question, I think, to you, Kent. I mean, if you look down the road 3 or 4 years, what makes you optimistic about what you're doing at the center, and what do you hope it looks like 3 or 4 years down the road?
Well, my personal viewpoint is I was, I'm interim. I was interim to come and help the process of moving this to the College of Ag and getting going again. So what I'm looking forward to is the fact that right now they're in the process of recruiting an associate dean who will have real responsibility for this and will be merging both the international programs activities and this World Food Center activity, and they will be continuing. And, you know, in terms of what I'd like to see it do, we have sort of an image for the World Food Center. One is that it's a megaphone. That is, it helps to expand awareness of what we have and expand awareness of the new innovations that are happening here. But you can turn that around, and it's kind of a funnel. So that is, it's out searching for actively for things that we need to do, or it's an opportunity to be a portal that anybody locally or globally that wants to know something about food, you know, we probably have something to say about it, or at least we could direct you to good information.
Well, listen, I really appreciate your taking the time to share this story. That's a great story. There's lots going on at the World Food Center. And Dr. Kent Bradford, thanks for being on Farm to Table Talk.
Thanks so much for having me.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.